morning to those making submissions and also members of the Committee of Trade and Industry. Some I haven't seen yet, but I certainly hope that everyone has had an opportunity to take time off with their families and to refresh their spirits and be ready for a very tough year ahead from wherever you are. So thank you very, very much. And to those who have already started work in earnest in everything, thank you for your long meetings this morning in trying to prepare for these public hearings. So I understand then, and you're very welcome, DDG Zodwa and Thule. I have already greeted the other members, but I heard you were just at the back, I think. We do need to just indicate that Mr. Hermans, our committee secretary, is on study leave at the moment, and unfortunately I only have the one part of the name just offhand, but that's Mr. Gershon. Yes, is that right? Thank you. And he's a very senior member too of the administration, the committee section, well versed in how to run committees. So we're all in good hands here this morning. And of course, Ms. Hurling on my right. My apologies to you for opening late. We were engaged in very serious other issues directly affecting the piece of legislation that is here before you. We have two members, or two presentations or submissions. We have Mr. C. Wolfson and Wolfson and Associates, who I'm sure are here first with us. And then we have Mr. D. Milo, or Milo, for Understand the Mail and Guardian. Is that correct? I'm not sure who you are and where you are for that matter. Right, okay. I thought you were a member of the department. Just goes to show that I don't know what you look like, you see. Okay. So we're going to, having apologised to you, the way we'll set this up, you were allocated. I think there's a mistake here. There's a little, let's see. I don't know, 10:35 to 11:15. So basically, if we can turn this into about from your side, half an hour at the most, and then engagements from our side. Is that in order? Right. We'll learn, we'll be able to focus in on what we need to know. So please introduce yourselves individually and then proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I've taken the liberty of bringing with me another small and medium practitioner, Mr. Peter Meredith. And outside I saw Ewald Muller, who's Director of Standards for PSYCHO, and I thought he could join us as well. As a small practitioner for the past 6.5 years, and having previously been a partner of a large accounting firm for 19 years, I'm honoured to be invited to present to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry this morning. At the outset, I must congratulate the Department of Trade and Industry on producing a new Companies Act. In particular, the whole issue of no longer having to audit certain companies is most welcome. Similar to closed corporations, which don't need to be audited, at least we are moving a step ahead to let our international partners understand the concept of closed corporations, and we'd welcome any future moves to disband closed corporations and convert to companies. I think one needs to understand certain fundamentals, and my whole discussion today is the effect on small practices, accounting firms, but more particularly small business, small and medium-sized businesses.
It is not normal practice for us not to be able to engage with a written document as well in front of us for so long. And I understand we won't even get this for Friday.
Unfortunately, I was away when he just returned. But there will be the document will be submitted by Friday.
You can appreciate it's very difficult for us to go blow by blow.
I understand, but I'm not going to go too technically. I'm going to be talking about the effects on the practice. practical effects of the regulations more so.
Right, thank you.
But I wanted to put it in perspective first, and I'm calling it the fundamentals. And we need to put in perspective what actually a SME or small medium enterprise is. And this is really defined as including companies where there's up to 130 employees, where turnover is about 150 million rand. Liabilities are 30 million rand, and assets are 60 million rand. So it's quite substantial figures. In South Africa at the moment, we have about 450,000 companies. Of these, only 40,000 are actually public companies. There are some 2 million closed corporations in South Africa. So in total, approximately 2.5 million corporations at Cipro. Of these, only one-third lodge their annual duties to Cipro. 76% reflect a turnover of less than 1 million rand. So what I'm trying to get across is that there's a substantial number of these entities that are actually affected in terms of the classification of small businesses. One can't separate the amendment bill from the regulations. The issues we face are actually with the regulations. The purpose of the new act is to make business simpler. We need to remove barriers to entry. We need to assist in building small business, small and medium enterprise businesses, as this is the area where jobs are actually created. However, the new regulations create a number of challenges. I have to ask why all company forms have to be renumbered. We haven't had sight of these, the new company forms, but we are seeing from the regulations that they're all renumbered. The filing of a memorandum of incorporation for all companies is not practical and mainly of no value. The timing of having to establish whether a company requires an audit or an independent review is actually crucial. We are 6 weeks ahead now of the financial year end, and accounting firms don't know now what's going to actually happen, which companies are going to be reviewed, which companies are going to need an audit. The vast majority of companies have a February year end. The planning of the 2011 audits have already commenced. At present, there's great uncertainty as to the interim arrangements and which companies will be affected, specifically companies that have a February or subsequent year-end. Small and medium enterprise accounting firms train some 50% of chartered accountants in South Africa. Accounting firms are waiting to finalize the finalization of the regulations to complete their planning of both audits as well as staffing requirements. And these staffing requirements are not just for the current year, but actually for the next 3 years. Public interest. The Consumer Protection Act aims at protecting consumers. However, the New Companies Act and the regulations do not offer sufficient protection to the public. I'm concerned that a convicted criminal is allowed to be a director of an owner-managed company. This does not protect the public. Dealing with the public, in my view, is in the public interest. Creditors are not afforded any protection under the new act. Employees of a company are regarded as stakeholders of a company, but creditors are not. The majority of SMEs use the services of professional accountants to assist with the preparation of annual financial statements, as well as to perform various secretarial functions. Under the new act, an officially appointed auditor of that company is precluded from performing these functions. Accountability, very, very serious issue. South Africa is rated number one in accounting and auditing in the global competitiveness survey. The worldwide trend is simplify small company administration. In South Africa, we are striving to make things simpler. However, we should not lose sight of the national interest. The EU Green Paper on Audits is as a result of the financial crisis in Europe, which strives to break the power of the Big Four accounting firms. Our current act and regulations goes in the opposite direction, creating barriers to both entry as far as the entry into the accounting profession as well as into business itself. Simplification does not mean losing accountability. Incorporation as a company grants limited liability, but there must be a corresponding accountability, which includes maintaining proper accounting records, preparing appropriate financial statements on which informed decisions can be taken, skilled professionals applying their mind and reporting accordingly, directors to take responsibility for misleading financial information, a particular structure for identifying and reporting irregularities. The solvency and liquidity test should be on a per company basis and not on a group basis. Business rescue can only work if there's credible financial information. I now want to turn to the public interest score, and that is in the regulations. The National Small Business Act defines small businesses, and the public interest score, I believe, should tie in with this, namely where you're limited to 50 shareholders, 150 employees, where turnover is greater than 120 million rand, liabilities in excess of 30 million rand, which equates to assets over 60 million rand. The top threshold should therefore be amended to 350 points. The lower threshold should be based on 80 points. 80 points equates to 5 shareholders, 50 employees, 20 million rand turnover, and 5 million rand liabilities. Many of the current listed companies today will not even reach the 750 points as proposed in the regulations. I wish now just point to touch on a couple of the particular definitions and sections of the Act. We'll not go into too much depth in terms of technicalities. But we look at Section 1, the definition of financial statements and annual financial statements. These should be, the definition of annual financial statements and financial statements should be precisely defined so as to ensure consistency and avoid uncertainty. By way of illustration, IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standard, states that a complete set of financial statements comprises a statement of financial position at the year end, a statement of comprehensive income for the period, a statement of changes in equity for the period, a statement of cash flows for the period, and notes comprising a summary of significant accounting policies and other explanatory information, as well as a statement of financial position when you're doing comparatives and certain restatements of changes of reclassification in the financial statements. Section 1 also refers to the law of trusts. As trusts are included in the definition of juristic person, the law of trust may unintentionally be affected. I suggest that this should be clearly identified and indicated that the definition of juristic person applies for the purposes of this Act only. Section 2 refers to related degrees of consanguinity. The definition of related person includes up to 3 degrees of consanguinity. This is far too wide and should be limited to 1 degree, basically immediate family only. Could have, if you widen it to 3 degrees, can have so many unintended consequences. Section 4 refers to solvency and liquidity. The solvency and liquidity test set out in Section 4 is a critical part of the law, but it impacts on the rights of shareholders, creditors, employees, and on the duties of directors and officers of the company. It's essential that the provisions of this section be clear and robust. The section as presently drafted includes various concepts of an accounting and financial nature that are likely to confuse various stakeholders. Subsection 1A prescribes the test of whether the company's assets are equal to or exceed its liabilities. The companies whose assets are equal to the liabilities should not be regarded as solvent. This test should be applied to the company itself and not the whole group structure. This certainly will give protection to the creditors and employees. Subsection 2A provides that the accounting records and financial statements of the company must be used as a basis of the solvency test. This section, I believe, should be deleted, as the financial records could well bear no relationship or no resemblance to the fair market value of the assets of a company. The directors of a company, in assessing the fair value of the company's assets and liabilities, will invariably take into consideration all the relevant facts, including the financial records. Section 22 refers to reckless trading. This section is far wider than our old Act, and now includes carrying on business recklessly with gross negligence and fraudulent intent. The phrasing used makes it unclear whether all 5 conditions need to apply simultaneously or whether they are to be regarded as 5 separate grounds or 5 separate tests. Trading under insolvent circumstances is now prohibited. However, this needs to be defined, and particularly needs to deal with subordinated loan accounts, as well as include the case where a company is unable to pay its debts. Section 24.3 refers to document retention and lays down the period for retention of all company documents to 7 years. This is far too short a period, as the rights and obligations of shareholders and others often continue for far longer than 7 years. A company's memorandum of incorporation, its rules, financial statements, minutes, and resolution should be retained indefinitely until a company is deregistered. I want to turn to section 31B, where certain companies need not prepare financial statements. This section provides for owner-managed businesses not to have to prepare financial statements. As I said previously, a director, a convicted criminal could be a director of one of these companies. This section, I believe, should be deleted on the basis that the protection of limited liability should only be provided on condition that financial statements are actually prepared. This will further conform to the corporate governance principles provided for in the bill. Unless annual financial statements are prepared, creditors and employees would have no proof of any recklessness. Madam Chair, I've just selected some of these smaller issues, which I believe are very serious issues, that will be affecting the practices of small and medium enterprises. As I said, small and medium enterprises comprise the majority number of companies and press corporations registered in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Borgson. Does your colleague wish to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Meredith. I have 30-odd years experience in professional practice, and my experience relates mainly to small and medium companies and advice to them. So I think I am in a position to have an overview of what the market requires in South Africa. The one issue that I would like to emphasize that Colin spoke about is accountability. The whole concept of limited liability, in my view, must have a concomitant accountability aspect to it. Failing which, anybody who does not wish to be accountable to employees, customers, suppliers, government, would simply incorporate and operate behind the curtain of limited liability. And if we do not have a structure which is robust and monitored, we have a real issue in this respect. Colin spoke about convicted criminals who are able to be directors of companies. In my view, that's only part of it. If you were to have motorists on the road who have road rules that they must follow, but nobody policing those rules, what is the point in having the rules in the first place? The solvency and liquidity provisions of the new Act, in my view, provide a very good foundation for monitoring whether directors are in fact trading in a responsible manner in the interests of all their stakeholders. However, those regulations can only be effective if somebody is seeing what's going on. And this is where the questions in the regulations relating to the appointment of accounting officers and their appropriate qualifications, the questions whether certain companies should not be required to prepare financial statements, these become very, very relevant. Failing sorting those issues out, we might as well not have the solvency and liquidity provisions. If you do not have accurate and credible financial records, you have nothing. You have no basis for assessing the solvency and liquidity. You have no basis for business rescue. You have no basis for knowing whether a company is trading or is not trading recklessly. And in my view, these provisions are fundamental to the Act. I believe that if a creditor, a supplier, which it could include SARS, for example, is rendering service to a company, that creditor is entitled to believe that they will be paid. and they're entitled to the same rights that they would have if they were dealing with the individuals behind the company in their personal capacities. For example, under the Consumer Protection Act, people have certain rights. Those rights should not be taken away because somebody decides to hide behind a curtain of limited liability. So with a limited liability, in my view, it's critical that responsibility and accountability go hand in hand. Together with that is the question of reporting irregularities. If a company is not complying with certain regulations, at the present moment, under the 1973 Act, the auditors appointed in terms of the Auditing Profession Act are required to report any irregularities that they might come across in the course of their audit. When the audit falls away, that requirement will fall away, which means that probably for 90% of companies, there will be no reporting requirement whatsoever of any irregularities. Now, to my mind, there is a glaring gap here that the Auditing Professions Act will not regulate that 90% of the companies, and I think that it is necessary to have some requirement in the Act for reporting of irregularities, and that should be written into the Companies Act itself. If the accountability of companies is such that anybody dealing with that company or any stakeholder in the company, which could include employees, can rely on the fact that that company is being conducted responsibly and there is a monitoring process in terms of reporting irregularities, I believe that the entire structure of the Companies Act will be strengthened tremendously. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meredith. Well, members, we've heard from Mr. Wolfson and we've heard from Mr. Meredith on this matter. Unfortunately, we don't yet have their written input, but nevertheless, they indicated that they tried to address the concerns and challenges facing some of the smaller companies. So I'll see by a show of hands, members who would like to clarify issues, raise questions all at once. So we're starting off at the bottom there with Honourable Mabasa, Honourable September, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Harris. Thank you. In that order.
Thank you, Comrade Chair, and expressing thanks to the two gentlemen for the input they have made. But my question would be, from the inputs standpoint, you know, from the people that made the inputs, ideally, from their perspective, what would they want us as a committee to do?
Thank you very much, Honourable September.
Chair, thank you very much. First of all, Chair, may I apologise if I slip out. I just need to go to another meeting. And then secondly, Chair, also thank you very much for the presentation. May I ask the following? The first thing is I heard quite a bit of how you spoke about, you know, barriers of entry for businesses in South Africa. What I'd like to know is, generally speaking, South Africa is still dominated by the fact that is characterized by the fact that we have a large group of very, very big companies, whether we call them multinationals or whatever, and then we have sort of a fledging group of emerging and small businesses whose lifespan is not always a long lifespan. Now, everything that you have raised, will it change that trajectory and flatten the situation to the extent where we will have a substantial amount of smaller businesses emerging, but not only emerging, they will be able to be sustainable? So I want to find out, you know, the issues that you have raised, does it hinge on that, you know, we will not have sustainable businesses and the rest? The second one, I mean, I will really hear you on the aspect of accountability and all the issues that you raise with it relatedly. I do want to ask, would there be any impediment on the labor legislation if we would to proceed with the amendments? The reason why I'm asking that is because employers have the obligation of giving all sorts of information, financial and others, in terms of their own accountability everywhere. And lastly also, if any employer decides to retrench, one of the things that they should do is also provide information on, you know, the health or otherwise of the business. Will it impede on all of that in what you are raising? I equally, Chair, would like to know, what then are your proposals to this committee? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable September. Right, Honourable Becky. Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, first of all, a person has to appreciate this input. Actually, I think that is touching on very sensitive issues which a person might have overlooked when looking at the Act, but what I'd like to know is that one of the objectives of this bill is to make the SMEs to do business easier, make it easier for them. But when coming to this issue of the retention of documents, I hear that they've got a problem with that the minutes of incorporation of the company must be there forever. Is it not going to create higher cost for the small business? And then how do they suggest we do it? They do it. Because, for example, even when coming to the issues of accountability, if those small businesses, I know of a small company in my area, which is just establishing, because of, you know, they have to retain the accountants. Actually, the bill of the accountants is so huge, it's such that it becomes a factor in the profitability of the business itself, because it's so small, because they want to be clear with SARS, with everything. Will this issue of this exemption not help the small business, or what do they propose to be the alternative if we are really going to achieve the objective of making the business easier for the small companies? But I really appreciate the input which you have made. It's good.
Thank you very much. Yes, Honourable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I just want to stress that it's really complicated trying to deal with an amendment bill of an act which amends an existing act, as in itself with copies of the presentation. It's almost impossible to do it without copies of the presentation. So I'm looking forward to getting them, and hopefully, what I'm hoping is that those notes or whatever accompanies the presentation indicate the relevant sections of the act, or of the bill rather. There was a concern raised around interim arrangements, and that brings up the question of the implementation dates. And we had last year some people presenting who told us, I think it was the Banking Association, who said that they felt that they needed two additional years. I'm wondering if the small auditors believe that it is possible in terms of their clients to have their clients compliance by the effective date that's on the table now, and if not, how much extra time do they feel they would need? Secondly, they raised an issue around, I think it was a discrimination against perhaps small audit firms and perhaps making it difficult for smaller firms or perhaps making it difficult for smaller operators to enter the accounting profession. Can they just unpack that a little and explain where exactly in the Act those constraints are. Then the split between the regulations and the bill, there was a concern around the regulations raised, but without having notes, it was difficult for me to follow which concerns apply to the regulations and which concerns apply to the bill. I hope that's detailed in the notes. If not, can you explain them? And do you believe that perhaps some items in the regulation should have been in the legislation itself? And then lastly, I believe the analogy was used that if we have traffic laws that we can't enforce, there's no point in having the laws. And it was raised, I think, with regards to the sections that deal with convicted fraudsters and company directorships. The implication there is that I think the legislation doesn't provide sufficiently for our enforcement of those directorships. Now, the section of the bill is much smaller right now. It's simply one paragraph relative to the quite detailed explanation of how those directorships must be enforced in the 1973 Act. Is that what the presenters are alluding to? Are you suggesting that we need to unpack how that enforcement needs to happen? Are you suggesting that the existing clause is insufficient and will therefore somehow undermine enforcement? Or what? Or are you talking about capacity of the state to enforce the law? That's it, Chair.
Very much, Honourable Harris. It may be constructive, I think, at this point for you to respond, and then should there be a further round, we can entertain that. So over to you again, Mr. Wolfson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a group, I think we're going to deal with some of the questions. And I'm going to leave the first question to last. What should we as a committee be doing? That's the first question. The second question was really regarding the barriers to entry. And that the whole issue that is, we are saying that although the intention of the new Act and the regulation is to make it easier for businesses to start and commence, certainly these fledgling businesses, because that's where employment is created, we are finding some challenges here in the current regulations that's going to make it more difficult and more expensive. And let's not hide away from the costs. The cost issue will come up later in another question. The sustainability of a business is crucial, and you need professional help. I mean, not all small businesses have the capacity to start off having full-time employees with the capabilities of a professional accountant. And certainly professional accountants are there to assist small businesses, but they can only do so if they have credible financial information. The accountability in terms of the labor legislation and providing information to employees, well, in certain cases, and there could be quite many, a large percentage of these small companies, owner-managed companies, aren't even required currently to keep financial records. So how can they be able to provide credible or any information to the employees? As far as the comment was made, or what about what happens in the case of retrenchment? Or if a company is not keeping proper accounting records, and unfortunately, for every 90 good apples, there are always the 10 bad apples. And we are trying to protect the creditors of a company as well as the employees of a company. At least if there are proper accounting records, we're not saying that those accounting records have to be audited. We're saying that each company should have a credible accounting record and not hide behind the corporate veil and just do whatever they want to do. The retention of documents question, there is no cost of retaining that particular document. We're talking about the memorandum of incorporation. Today, all those sort of documents are kept indefinitely for a company. There's no cost of retaining those documents. It's not a box. It's really a very small document. But we do have to talk about the cost, because all current companies will have to change the current memorandum and articles of association. We'll have to change all to these new documents. And that's going to be a cost. And in most cases, not accounting firms won't be qualified to do it. We're going to have to go to legal firms to do it. I'm not knocking the legal profession. I'm just concerned about the cost of having to change this. I'm concerned about the cost of all these forms, the plethora of company documentation that are all being renumbered. All these forms are now, I'm assuming, going to have to be re-prepared for each and every company. there's going to be a cost to that. Before the question, we talked about the interim arrangements. My concern there is we are 6 weeks now prior to year end. The audit firms at this stage are already planning the audits for February year end. An audit doesn't only start after year end. In fact, it starts 6 weeks prior to the company's year end. And we're not quite sure of the, at the moment we're told the implementation date is the 1st of April, but we're not sure, and we can't understand from the regulations, does it mean that a company's year end at February, which is prior to April, needs to be audited or doesn't need to be audited? If a company's year end is April, May or June, can we assume that those companies won't need an audit for the year ended April, May or June 2011? The concern of small accounting firms is not that we can't handle the work. It's the cost involved of us having to restructure ourselves to assist our clients. And this is where I spoke about earlier in the presentation. Majority of small and medium enterprises rely on us as the accountants, which we might, in today, in the 73 Act, act as accountants and auditors. We provide the accounting information and those accounting services. We provide the secretarial services. We need to know, we need to have sight of these forms so we can prepare for it, to be able to assist our clients. Hopefully that regulation will be changed and we'll be able to assist our clients. The question was, should some regulations be contained in the actual legislation? And the answer is yes, and in our presentation we will be specifying those. I spoke about earlier about what constitutes appropriate financial statements and your financial statements. At the moment, the regulations give examples of a couple of documents. It doesn't refer to what is worldwide widely accepted as IFRS. And there's another whole discussion going on at the moment about the actual content of the financial statements and whether they should be retained in this very modern format or go back to what we, in the old days, knew as cost, as reflecting assets and liabilities at cost. The concern we had in terms of criminals being directors goes against the grain of what we've all been trained about. Somebody who's been convicted of a crime should not be put into a position of trust and have the fiduciary duty of being a director of a company. Now, if somebody's been convicted of a crime and maybe even liquidated or made insolvent, that person is precluded from trading. But currently, they can hide behind the corporate veil, form a company today, own a managed company, not required to be audited, not required to even prepare financial statements. And we are concerned there the effect of on creditors and on employees. And I mean, the whole concept of having this lessened burden, I think with respect have gone too far. Foreign investors wanting to invest in a company in South Africa or invest in South Africa want to deal with credible companies, knowing that there's a proper set of regulations, proper set of legislation. The regulations and legislation are properly monitored and know that they're dealing with a company where they will be provided, you know, be paid for services or products and not have their money taken away. The very last point is, what do we expect this committee to do? Well, hopefully to listen to our presentation and listen to the issues that we've raised. As a practitioner, I'll make myself available for further meetings if we're required. I saw Mr. Goldmuller in the passage here. He's the head of standards of our institute. And I asked him to come and join me here. And I'm sure FICA would offer their assistance as well if we could assist the committee in any way. But I'm aware that FICA has made substantial submissions in the past. Many of those points contained in the submissions have been taken into account in amending the regulations. But I think the Department of Trade and Industry has gone such a long way to redraft and make a more simplified act. The regulations as they stand at the moment just need a bit of refining. And particularly when one looks at accountability and responsibility, those public interest scores need to be re-looked at because, as I said, majority of listed companies today would not even get the score 750, so I really would suggest that we relook at the score and so that public interest companies are falling within the realms of audits.
Madam Chair, thank you, Colin, for those comments. I was here last year presenting on behalf of SAICA. I think that last point that Colin raised is very important. I think this act moves away from the principles of the 73 Act substantially in a sense which I think is appropriate, that it introduces a raft of regulation and the concept of regulation which was not really part of the 73 Act. I think to answer the question of what this committee needs to do, I do not think that we need to try and change the way legislature works in South Africa by saying that the regulations must go through a full parliamentary process, but the regulations give effect to the objectives of this Act and how it will affect every single company. There's one primary issue, and that is critical in this Act, and that is the distinction between public interest and private. We all fully endorse the fact that private companies should be given the opportunity to create sustainable business in this country. SME creates employment. Large employers do not necessarily do that. We need SME in this country. We need to encourage it. What we need to do as this committee is to have a very careful look at some of the issues that have been raised here, and I know McDonald will smile at me right now again, of course, because we will go back to my favorite, Section 22, which practically is an impediment to doing business. 22Q, not 221B, should I say. We need to think about those things, and we need to think about how the regulations affect doing business in South Africa. And I think that is where this committee needs to spend a bit of time deliberating whether those objectives are being achieved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions, comments, clarifications? Yes, Honourable Smaller.
Thank you, Chair. I just would like to ask the presenters just to broaden the public scoring of the audit to 750 points, and presently I think you proposed 300 or 500, sorry if I missed, because I didn't take note of that stat. What is the actual effect that it's actually going to have on SMEs? Are we talking about a substantial percentage of SMEs that are being affected if we do adjust to a different point system, 10%, 5% growth in that sector? And, I don't want to repeat what others have said. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments, questions, or clarifications from the committee? Yes, thank you.
May I respond on the point system? I think the difficulty we have at the present moment is, what is an SME? What is a small company? It's a question which varies from country to country. If you look at the definition of a small company in the United States, I understand that reference was made recently that any company with less than $1 billion of turnover is a small company. If you go to the UK or you go to Europe, I think their definitions of small companies, again, are very, very different from ours. And what might be a small company in the UK could be a medium-sized company within South Africa. And I think the danger we have here is if we pitch the level of scoring too high, all we're doing is excluding most companies from the regulation which the Companies Act has set up to put in place. And to me it seems totally ridiculous that you could have listed companies on the Altex list in South Africa which would not fall within the requirement for audit. So on the one hand you're saying because it's a listed company, it's a public company, it needs an audit. But if you apply the test as it stands at the moment, the 750 points, it would not fall within, a lot of those companies would not fall within that ambit. And so clearly, while I think we support the principle of having a basis for determining who should and who should not be audited, there are some large and companies with a lot of stakeholders and people who are affected by this who would simply be excluded from the regulation. And we believe that in the public interest, they should not be excluded from the regulation, which is why we are simply trying to find a more practical level. We're not saying there should not be a level. We believe there should be, that small owner-managed companies should not have massive costs of audit and so on. We're absolutely in agreement with that. What we do say, though, is that if a company employs 200 people, those people have, there are a lot of people with a lot of interest in proper regulation within that company. And if that company is going to enter into any cross-border trade, for example, there is going to be an expectation of proper control. And that's really what we're trying to get to here. And I think that the point here is that we shouldn't rush into getting a number just for the sake of it and come up with the wrong answer, which perhaps we have to revisit down the track. Revisiting the audit question is an incredibly onerous situation. If a company dispenses with an audit, it cannot simply decide in 2 years' time, well, it'll now audit for 1 year and step out again. It's a very, very complex, costly, and with a lot of consequences attached to it. So I think what we're really saying here is that this is something which should be thrashed out. The question was raised about how much time do small and medium firms of accountants believe we should extend the implementation date by. I think the answer to that is we're not saying we need 2 years to be able to implement. What we're saying is we probably need some more time to hammer out these practical issues in the regulations on the one hand, and we need interim processes on the other hand which can define very clearly that the existing Companies Act will apply until, for example, the date of implementation. So we cannot have an act which becomes effective, let's say, on the 15th of March, and with an implementation date on the 1st of April, and people have got 2 weeks to know whether they should or shouldn't do an audit for the year to February 2011. It's the lack of ability to plan here, which I think is what's worrying us. So if we have enough time to sort out the regulations, which in my personal view I believe could be done within 6 months, and we had proper interim arrangements, I believe that small business would be able to cope.
Thank you very much indeed. Just one or two questions on myself and perhaps comments. Indeed, we appreciate you coming along here to make the submission to us, as it does deal with some of the smaller organizations, companies, and so on, who may be experiencing challenges. So we do appreciate you coming here and sharing it with us. Just two or three things. You referred to technical or insolvency yourself. And perhaps I didn't hear you, but did you refer to the situation of being technically insolvent while commercially solvent at all? And the situation, in your view, that should prevail, shouldn't prevail, that's the one issue. The other issue is the issue of persons being allowed to act as directors who have been removed from offices of trust for either misconduct involving dishonesty or imprisoned and or otherwise facing a fine or imprisoned without the option of a fine of a statutory lock, that aspect. And then the third one is on the business rescue, which, as you know yourself, probably coming from where you do and representing the people you do, I would imagine that you were concerned and perhaps even welcomed the principle of business rescued being applied in a particular manner. So starting with the last, it would be useful to hear from you with respect to business rescue. What are some of the key issues you see that may be an impediment or provide challenges to the smaller organizations in this regard? The second thing is on, as I said, related to the persons allowed to act as directors. There are quite a few people, as you know, as our demographics go, and even internationally, who in their youth, and when I say youth, perhaps I'm not even talking of 30 years old, but younger, may well have found themselves in conflict with the law in this regard, under the references you refer to, and truly make every effort to change. And indeed, our whole constitution is developed around the principle of wanting people to improve themselves, respecting these rights and so on, and developing a better quality of life. In other words, giving them that another chance. So it would be quite interesting and valuable for us to hear how you would approach this, while on the one hand acknowledging the importance of ensuring that people who have developed this track record of trust and integrity are in there. What about those who in an early part of their lives may have fallen foul of the law in this regard? And then again, as I said, the technical insolvency versus commercial. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think the first point that I would like to deal with is that the one about certain people who might have been misdirected in their youth or something and having a problem. The radio lately is a big drive against drunk drivers, a big effort sponsored by one of the well-known breweries. And it states that that person wants to be practicing today as an attorney, however cannot, because in their youth was convicted of drunk driving. And that applies exactly to what you're saying. I have no problem with people being given a second chance. I actually subscribe to that. The problem is one has to look at the criminal offence that person particularly committed, how long ago that person committed. So off the top of my hat, I would change that regulation to accommodate what you're saying. Has not been convicted of a crime in the last 10 years. There's some precedence for that in terms of people having made financial mistakes, being declared insolvent, and after 10 years that the debt and the insolvency is totally expunged. So that could be a short-term thing. Obviously, one needs to just talk about that. These are the kind of questions that we raised, and Peter said earlier that he thought maybe 6 months. I believe the regulations can be changed in far less than 6 months. So maximum could be 6 weeks, could be even 3 months maximum to fine-tune some of these things. The technical insolvency issue is an issue. Currently, the 73 Act says that the company could be technically insolvent, but not practically insolvent. we have a situation where a loan account from the shareholders or directors may be subordinated, and that would restore the solvency of a company. That provision doesn't apply in the Closed Corporation Act. What I was saying in my presentation is that I believe that that provision should be reinstated or put into the new Act, so that you have a situation where you can have technical insolvency, but on, and as auditors, when we prepare the financial statements or actually perform the audit, we insist we need that legal document, because that the directors or shareholders have subordinated that loan account. That is a very crucial point, because as we know, it alludes to certain questions earlier, 75% of businesses fail in the first year. That's a worldwide statistic. It does apply in South Africa. 75% of businesses fail in the first year. That's not what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to make life easier for business. Yes, those businesses that fail usually is because of a matter of incorrect funding or too high cost of funding. But looking at the overall structure, the cost of running a business, of doing a business, so certainly the subordination of loan accounts would go a long way to restoring the solvency of a company, and that we, I believe is crucial to be reinstated. Peter wants to talk to the specifics about the business rescue.
I think the business rescue provision is a very interesting one. What we do know is that our insolvency law in South Africa at the present moment has not worked particularly well. The difficulty that we have is that when the time comes that a liquidator is appointed, it's too late. The horse is bolted. There are no funds. The inventory is worthless. The accounts receivable are not collectible, basically because the directors have already tried everything they can. There's very little a liquidator can do, quite often, to realize value out of the assets that are there. The result of that is that the net proceeds going to creditors at the end of the day are far lower than they ought to be. That is the bottom line of I think, the insolvency failure today as things stand. And the result of that is that creditors are asked by the liquidator in a creditors meeting, would you like to accept 25 cents in the rand today, or would you like to contribute to an investigation to see whether we should pursue the directors for reckless trading? And that might follow into a discussion, well, what's in it for us? Well, what's in it for you is, well, you'll have to wait 2 years longer to be paid a dividend, and your dividend might well be lower than it is now. And for practical reasons, the creditors say, well, our first loss is our best loss. Let's take it, and we'll leave it like that, and we'll sweep the problems under the carpet. And I think my belief is that that is what is happening in insolvency today. So the business rescue provisions are really interesting in that they provide an opportunity at a much earlier stage for somebody to actually have a look at what is really going on. Is there a problem or isn't there a problem? My real concern with the business rescue is that the practitioner who is going to enforce that or going to run the business rescue is going to rely on the information that is given, and that comes back to the accountability issues that I was talking about before. And I think that there is great promise in the business rescue provisions, but only if there are proper accounting records and they're properly monitored by a suitably qualified person. So I think these provisions are so absolutely critical to business rescue. And I don't know whether that deals with the question adequately.
Very, very much. I just wanted to be sure we had everyone's name here. It was Mr. Colin Wolfson, Mr. Peter, practicing chartered accountant, Mr. Peter Meredith, also practicing chartered accountant, and is it Mr. Ewald if you'd be kind enough to hand over your seat then to Miss, or Doctor, is it? Nina. Thank you very much. I'm just looking here. I know we've had a rolling tea break. Just reminding members, we're not having a set tea break as such. I'm not sure if there's coffee or tea outside. I don't think so. Am I right? I'm just checking with you. There is coffee and tea outside. So there is very much a rolling tea break here, and please help yourself and then come back into the meeting itself. Everyone there to leave. Those who are just leaving at this point or popping up. Of course, we are going to continue the rolling tea break. But it may be useful for us to just check with everyone. Wouldn't like key members of committee, I see how many are missing. Got about two missing, is it, or three? Two. Right. Well, obviously we are continuing with our public hearing under this very important piece of legislation, a proposed legislation that comes before us as an amendment bill. And before us we have Dr. Dario Milo, who is just looking at your submission here. You're from Webber and Wenzel itself, according to this, Johannesburg, South Africa. But in actual fact, you're doing this on behalf of the MNG Centre. I undertook, I see that that's put down on the program as the Mail and Guardian Centre for Investigative Journalism. Is that correct? Right.
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Dr. Milo, there are just one or two things that I would like to clarify with yourself. First of all, I regrettably only got this last night, myself, at about 5:30 or so, and I noticed that it addressed a number of issues around the Promotion for Access to Information Act. Is that correct? And I was also aware that particular committee dealing with that, because as you know, that is currently before Parliament as well, to look at a review and amendments and so on. And they are dealing with precisely with that. So I just wondered if you had gone there as well to make any representations on behalf of your principals in any way.
Madam Chair, thanks very much for the opportunity to come and for the indulgence to the MNG Centre to make the written and this oral submission. Is Madam Chair referring to the Protection of Information Bill? Yes, we have made, I have appeared not for the MNG but for Print Media South Africa in that committee and tangentially dealt with the Promotion of Access to Information Act. But I hope to explain in the course of the presentation why we've raised as much as we have in the written submission on, if I can call it the short PIA, in the context of the company's amendment bill as we go through the submission.
The reason I ask this is because clearly, you know, with two committees dealing with pieces of legislation which are so close in this particular case, PIA, as you put it, you know, and ourselves, who I suppose you could argue that every piece of legislation, in a way, deals with PIA. You know, you could argue that, and every institution does. And clearly, we don't want to create further complexities than are already on the table. By pursuing this line and then finding people are pursuing another line in a different direction. So I think it's important to keep that in mind as we go through this. However, when I did look at this, I don't want to create the impression to the committee that I studied this, because I think very few of us had that opportunity. But what I did do was to briefly go through it. I noticed that you made direct reference to particular amendments in the bill itself on page 4, for example, clause 17, just to give you an example. And in that respect, clearly you were referring to the amendment bill, which is before this committee today. And as the public hearings are about the amendment bill, then of course, you know, any member of the public, in this case yourself, has a right to come here and pass comment. But we don't. I wouldn't like us to go down side streets, if you like, for this committee that may have already been tackled in the main, you know, with another committee. So if you would, as far as possible, I can see it's going to be very difficult, you see, try to deal with the amendment bill itself. That would be extremely helpful. Thank you very much. So that's Dr. Dario Milo, was it Milo? My apologies. And if we're looking at the time, as you see, it's probably now nearly 12 o'clock. If we can go on in the same kind of manner we've done before, do about half an hour or so, 20 minutes of input, and then let us engage. So over to you. I'm glad. I think everyone has got the documents, including the PowerPoint. Am I correct? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks also to all the members of the committee. I hope to illustrate in the course of the presentation why it is that we have dealt with PIA as we have, and also why it is that we hope to illustrate that there's a very neat solution which certainly doesn't involve you treading on the toes of any other committee that might be concerned peripherally with PIA. But I have to say, I don't think, I'm not aware of a large-scale review of PIA itself being considered by Parliament. The Protection of Information Bill actually doesn't deal with PIA as a direct issue in any event. But certainly our submission, as you'll see, is only about Clause 17 of the Companies Amendment Bill, which itself refers to PIA, and that's the only reason we raise it and address it. It's a very narrow point that we wish to make submissions on, and that is the amendments to Section 26 of the 2008 Act. And Section 26 of the 2008 Act, like Section 113 of the current 1973 Act, both recognize the right of public access to certain company information, particularly the securities register and the directors register. In other words, to know who owns and who controls companies. That is a trite right that has been recognized for hundreds of years in our corporations law, and it's uncontroversial that the 2008 Act in Section 26 and the current Act, Section 113, recognize that right. There are a number of reasons why the right is important of public access. We needn't get into it in detail because I think we're on the same page here, and it's common cause really that the public need to have access to the shareholders register and the directors register. But for example, it's important so that researchers can analyze the current state of the economy and determine the extent to which it has transformed, both for black empowerment purposes and other purposes, and to look at trends of ownership and control. It's important for investors to know the kind of company they might be wanting to invest in and who the shareholders are of that company. It's important to conduct investigative journalism. It's important to conduct research as, for instance, who McGregor's Who Owns Whom do into the ownership patterns of companies. I'm not going to labour that point, but if I can just remind you of Section 26 and what it currently says. It says that a security holder has a right to inspect and copy all kinds of company information. The ones that I'm particularly concerned with here today are, as I say, the securities register and the directors register. And it also says that that holder may exercise that right either by direct request to the company or in accordance with the Promotion of Access to Information Act, PIA. Then Section 26(3) says the register of members and the register of directors must be open to inspection by any member and by any other person. So there's the express articulation, rightly, of the right of a member of the public to access those registers. Now, what does Clause 17 do to Section 26? Firstly, it fixes the terminology problem. There is, as you will have recognized, a slight terminology problem because, in fact, the 2008 Act doesn't talk about a register of members, at least for profit companies. So Clause 17 does a good job of getting the terminology correct, and it now refers to the appropriate terminology, securities register and members register for non-profit companies. It also tries to streamline this right of access in a very admirable way, because I think the wording of Section 26 was slightly cumbersome in that regard. But our submission will be that in doing so, in trying to streamline the mechanism by which you can access information, both if you are a holder of the security or if you are a member of the public, there might be some unintended consequences that result, and that in effect, that if we are correct as to the possible interpretation of those consequences, would have the result that in fact access to the registers would be undermined because they would be thrust into a PIA process, which would be cumbersome, which would be which would take a long time, which would be costly and so on, as I'll talk about in a moment. And the reason this interpretation is possible, I would propose to you, is because Section 17(4) uses the conjunctive as opposed to the disjunctive. In other words, what it says is, and I've got it reproduced on the next slide, it says that a person, either a holder of a security or a member of the public, may exercise this access right for a reasonable period during business hours by direct request of the company and in accordance with PIA. Now, we say all our potential difficulties would be solved if the and were to be changed back to an or, as it is, in fact, in Section 26 of the 2008 Act, albeit only in the context of holders of security. So we welcome Clause 17(4) in that it seeks to apply the same regime of getting access to members of the public and to security holders. The problem is that the conjunctive, and lawyers, you know, argue about words like and all the time in court, but the problem is the conjunctive means that it is possible that a judge would say, this legislation is saying to the requester, you need to comply with all three of these, and in particular, our problem with that approach is that it then means the requester is forced to go the route of a PIA application. That's why we spend so much time, Madam Chair, on PIA in this submission. Because if we are correct that it is an interpretation, a possible interpretation of this section, that you have to go the PIA route, then the quickest you will get access to the register is within 30 days. And it's actually likely you will only get access much later, because of the way PIA works, which I'll illustrate in a moment. We're not making submissions here on the regulations to the Companies Act. There will be an opportunity for that, and we've noted the deadline of the end of the month. But it is interesting that Regulation 24, which deals with Section 26, seems to support this potential problematic interpretation which we are outlining. Regulation 24.2 says that a person requesting the right of access can't exercise that right until the right of access has been confirmed under PIA. And 24.3 says that you've got to submit the prescribed form as well as any further documents as may be required by PIA. So again, the theme, it seems, of Clause 17.4 and the regs, perhaps unintentionally, is pigeonholing the access right in a PIA box. It's saying to the requester, you have to exclusively rely on PIA to get access to the registers. Now, I'm not going to spend much time at all on the constitutional obligations of openness and transparency, or on the rights of access to information and freedom of expression, but suffice to say this, that the sound commercial rationales which have always existed for allowing members of the public access to these registers have effectively been reinforced by these constitutional obligations of transparency and openness. They buttress and they work together with the commercial rationales for allowing members of the public access to these registers. And so if anything, what we should be now doing is not weakening the Section 26 protection and the Section 113 protection for members of the public to access the registers, but strengthening it. And we don't strengthen it in our submission by saying the requester has to go the PIA route. The reason we don't strengthen it is because PIA is plagued as a matter of practice with difficulties. Now, this is not a committee that's looking at PIA, and I don't want to for a moment propose radical reform of PIA. That's not the purpose of this submission. But what we do know about PIA is that there are a number of hurdles that it puts in the place of a requester who wants information from a private body. Firstly, you've got to prove that the information is necessary to your rights. Secondly, there are numerous grounds of refusal that the private body can rely upon to kick your request into touch. Thirdly, there are lengthy bureaucratic procedures in place to deal with how you respond to these requests. And because a request for access to a register would always involve third parties, that is immediately invoked in a PIA request. What that means is that in addition to the 30 days, which a company usually has to respond to a PIA request, they now have an additional 21 days. So you're talking, in fact, about the earliest 51 days after the request is made before you get your shareholders register, if PIA is to be exclusively applicable. Now, I must emphasize that applies both on the wording of Clause 17 to members of the public and to existing security holders. And that, I think, also just shows the anomaly, probably the unintended anomaly, if this interpretation is the correct one. We've also attached to the length to the written submissions some empirical research from the Human Rights Commission and ODAC, but effectively the point is simple, and that is that PIA is problematic. It's not effecting its purpose of speedily entitling members of the public to information that they should get. And what we are saying is rather than forcing a requester to go the PIA route when there's absolutely no compulsion legally that says you have to do it that way, stick to the tried and tested formula of companies law through the ages and in terms of best practice internationally, which is to say, we know there's PIA out there. You can use PIA if you want. Of course you can, to get the information. But because in a commercial context, for commercial efficacy reasons, it's important that these registers are made available speedily and promptly, we're not going to require you to go through the hurdles of PIA. You can get it within 5 days, 7 days, 14 days. Those are the kinds of periods that apply internationally and under our 1973 Act. Again, it doesn't really require labouring the point that this kind of historical research or current research into shareholder trends and ownership of companies needs to be timeous. It doesn't help someone who wants to invest in a company and wants to know who the shareholders are and who the directors are if he only gets that in 6 weeks, 8 weeks down the line. and that is assuming there's no appeal to court and so on. It's going to stifle commerce if you say to a requester, you've got to go the pie route, and that's the bottom line. I'm not going to necessarily bore you with the Supreme Court of Appeals jurisprudence on pie, but I do want to simply end, before I conclude on how we propose this be fixed quite neatly, by also just reminding you of the provisions of the UK Act and the Australian Act. Now, the importance here is that both the UK and Australia also have freedom of information regimes, right? You can, under the UK Freedom of Information Act, you can request information of a public body, and similarly in Australia. But there's no linkage between their company legislation and those acts. They don't say go the equivalent of PIA route there. They say, in the UK, you want this register, you'll get it within 5 days. In Australia, they say, if you want the register, you'll get it within 7 days. And we are arguing for a similar position here in South Africa. We already have in Section 26 the principle. It's settled and established. The public have a right to access. What we're simply saying is, don't force the public to go the PIA route. Or, in fact, for that matter, don't force a holder of a security to go the PIA route, because then you are in the minefield that is PIA, and you are going to effectively stifle the prompt access to that information. So the way to fix this in our submission is actually very simple, and it's simply to change the conjunctive in Clause 17.4 back to a disjunctive, which was the position in Section 26, so that it says to a requester, of course you can go the PIA route if you want to, but you can also get this information by simply going to a registered office of a company and within reasonable office hours and inspecting the register, which of course as a matter of statute law has to be there, or you can make a written request to the company as a way of enforcing your rights. And we would propose that, it's not in that section there, the summary, but in fact it would make sense for the empowering legislation to say that that has to be responded to within a certain period. We would propose 7 days. Of course, this might be dealt with in the regulations. It isn't currently. But it makes sense to fix it up if you agree that there's a potential problem in the empowering legislation. Just a footnote before I end is that we also note that Section 26 seems to draw a distinction between inspection and copying. So everyone has the right to inspect, but only a member has a right to make a copy. Now, in practice, it simply facilitates access for a copy to be given, obviously subject to the payment of prescribed fees, also to members of the public. In fact, in England, for instance, most of this information is now available pursuant to request online immediately. We would simply say that Section 26.2 of the Act be changed to say that a person not contemplated, in other words, a member of the public, has a right to both inspect and copy these registers. It just facilitates the practicality of the issue. I don't think it's a major point. It shouldn't hopefully cause this committee much trouble. I'd be very happy to take questions and debate the issues with you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Dario Milo. Very much indeed. Members of the committee, we now have the opportunity to comment, question, or clarify. So over to ourselves. We've been given a PowerPoint plus, of course, an extensive piece of text. Honourable Harris, Honourable Kotze, Honourable Smalley, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I must just say first that I think it's a very compelling case the presenter makes. It seems like a relatively simple amendment, and I certainly agree with his argument. The only possible reason why you might not, I think, is perhaps something to do with compliance costs for especially smaller companies. So I'd be interested in the presenter's view on those costs, whether the 100 rand specified in his opinion is sufficient to make up for the time required or perhaps the financial resources required, if that amount perhaps should change, and whether allowing requests to be made without reference to PIA might perhaps prejudice smaller companies in terms of complying with that law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. very much, Honourable Cook.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, perhaps mine is perhaps to ask the department in when they would come back to us for response. There could be a reason why this is included, or maybe it was an oversight, but we would like at some time when they come in to give some responses to us to actually deal with that. And perhaps, yeah, I think that's where it goes. I think the presenter has put his position clear, and then I think that we need to decide on that.
Thank you very much.
Osmani?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Requesting changing the and or the or seems to be fine. It is on your regulations or on your proposals for a company to come back to with that information within 7 days. And you would hope that the majority of companies does come back in that time period, but you will not be able to force the information within 7 days. A company might just ask you to go the route of the Fire Act in that case, being difficult or not wanting to disclose certain information for various reasons. And I'm just interesting to understand your view in dealing with such a situation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments, questions or clarifications at this stage? Otherwise, we'll hand over immediately then to Dr. Dario Milo.
Thank you very much for the very important question. The Honourable Harris's question about compliance costs is, I think, a pertinent one. I don't know the answer because I don't work in the accounting industry, and I don't have enough contact with small companies to know whether this would be burdensome. But I can answer it in a legal sense, if you like, by saying that Section 16 of the Close Corporations Act, 1984, which is, of course, still applicable and will not be overruled, will not be superseded, makes this transparency obligation, puts this transparency obligation on closed corporations. So even with the smallest form of recognized corporate entity in the current regime, there is this the principle seems to apply. It might be that the 100 Rand is too low and that needs to be revisited and debated, but it doesn't seem to have been an issue up to now, both in terms of for private companies under the 1973 Act, who of course had to provide this information within 14 days, or for closed corporations under Section 16 of the Closed Corporations Act. It's perhaps an empirical question, but it's a pity that the accountants who deal more with small companies have left, I think, the building, much like Elvis, because perhaps they would have been more qualified than me to answer on an empirical basis. And it's a point worth flagging, but I don't think it's an issue that affects the principle. I think the principle has to apply to from the smallest form of company to the largest global multinational. And I don't think the costs of compliance, bearing in mind, of course, that these registers have to be accessible at the registered office of the corporation anyway, it doesn't seem to me to be, from a logical perspective, an onerous burden to make this available on request. And of course, they could be made available electronically as well. That would satisfy the statute. The second question was in relation to the enforcement. I think it's a very important question. And it's important. It's a question that I grappled with when thinking about this presentation with the MNG's Center for Investigative Journalism. The current position is 14 days. It might be that we stick with that. Perhaps 7 days is a little bit too short, and we're not going to require companies to perform within a week. But at the moment, the remedy is to go to court with an application, and it might be you have grounds to bring an urgent application, depending on the information you need to get it. Now, of course, any court process has all the the attendant problems of cost and access to court and resources and so on. We would have liked, and in fact when I made submissions on the company's bill as it then was in 2008, we had proposed, and I'm happy to send this to you by email, because I think it would be useful to your question in answering it. We had proposed a direct linkage between the access right and the various bodies that have been set up under the Companies Act of 2008, the tribunal in particular. And it might be that we would, of course, propose that that be revisited by way of effective enforcement. It seems to me at the moment the only way you can do it under the 2008 Act, if you get a recalcitrant company. Well, I suppose there are three consequences. The one is it's a criminal offence for a company not to give the information. But in my experience, that has become a bit of a dead letter because the police don't investigate necessarily those kinds of cases, having to prioritize much more important cases, and it doesn't get you the information in any event. But there is that disincentive to being a recalcitrant company, and that remains in Section 26. The second way is to go to court to enforce it, and there's an example of that in the PowerPoint slides with the La Lucia Sands Development Trust, where a requester had to go to court. Of course, that's unsavory for various reasons, which are probably too obvious to mention. The third at the moment is that you could do a complaint to the Commission, it seems to me, under Section 170 of the Companies Act. I don't know, and I have to confess I didn't explore that chapter fully for purpose of today's presentation, I don't know that that is enough to remedy the issue of requiring prompt access. But I would happily send our earlier proposal to you, perhaps tweaked in accordance with the current drafting, so that you can perhaps apply your mind, if you minded to that direct enforcement mechanism we had in mind 2 years ago. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much. It would seem then, Dr. Milo, that much of the concern that you have is really, on the one hand, when it comes to PIA, et cetera, and the access, is indicating that you don't have a problem with PIA, but the issue is perhaps it could be an alternative. I just found it interesting to wonder just when such an alternative would be forthcoming, if, as you say, you're saying all, you know, people would get this within 7 or 14 days or whatever it is. But if there was nothing to enforce that, because in a number of the cases you've indicated here, the courts have raised the area of the proliferation of litigation, etc., and you would want to avoid that. What would compel someone to disclose such information, in your opinion, having studied the Act? Because then you would say, or go the PIA route, which then would appear to be more compelling but long and convoluted, as it were, and could then wind up in court anyway. So perhaps you could just expand on that a little for us so that we can get it very clear in our heads as to what, why we would go the all route, as it were, instead of and. Or as you called it, what was it, the disjunctive?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's an important question. I think the answer is the following. PIA would apply in any event. So there's, in fact, no need to refer to PIA. You know, the easiest solution is simply to take out the reference to PIA because, of course, a member of the public who feels, for whatever reason, that they want to request this register via PIA is always entitled to do that because PIA is a piece of general legislation that's generally applicable, and provided you meet the procedural requirements under Section 51 of PIA for a private body, you are entitled to go that route. So I suppose my short answer to the question is there is absolutely no need for Section 26 or Clause 17, amending Section 26, to refer to PIA at all. There's no harm in putting it in because it simply states what applies anyway, but if it is if it's more palatable to remove some of the confusion by removing the reference to pi in its entirety, I would have absolutely no problem with that. You know, one wouldn't necessarily have these problems of pi if the periods were shorter in pi than they are, and if there was a mechanism of enforcement other than the courts, because what the Human Rights Commission is saying very pertinently is it's just too expensive and cumbersome and procedurally complex for requesters, often communities who request information about water and lights, to in fact go the route of a court case unless they find an NGO or pro bono law firm that's able to take the case on. So the neatest solution from a corporation's perspective, bearing in mind that we're talking about the commercial efficacy and not just constitutional obligation, which buttresses it, is, I think, to get rid of the pi reference or leave it in. It's not really important, but to avoid confusion, I would, my wish list would be take out pi in its entirety and go back to a direct explicit period of either 7 or 14 days and link that to an enforcement mechanism. That's my wish list, which we expressed in our 2008 submissions. But at least it would undo some of the potential unintended harm if it's stated in the disjunctive. That would at least undo some of the harm that we think might arise from that interpretation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Milo. Now, members, are there any outstanding comments? No. I think you've given us an extensive input here in terms of writing, so we can peruse this at our leisure. And of course, everyone is always welcome to continue to come to the public hearings, and the department will be responding on Tuesday the 25th. I understand. Is this correct, Ms. Herling? Right. In the morning. Yes, Honourable
Mabasa. Comrade Chair, it is just on the point where there was an offer of sending additional information. I will suggest that it gets done.
Right, I see you've been following it deeply. It's the 2008. Is that what you were referring to? Right, you said you will be emailing it, and of course you would continue to email it to the secretary, the committee secretary in this regard. Thank you very much to yourself, Dr. Milo. Members of the committee, they're just a couple of issues that we need to just ensure that you have. We're not, I understand that the program, I got a draft of the program, I'm not sure if anyone else did, but the program draft has undergone some changes in Manco, and also in view of the request at the Chair of Chairs meeting as well, that as far as possible, we stick to our particular day, and that is Wednesday, you know, in terms of Tuesday or Wednesday, unless there is an important reason why it can't be held on a Wednesday. And as you know, very often on the Wednesday, if not always, there is a cabinet meeting on Wednesday, so the minister would not automatically just be available to come and address us on that day. The second aspect here is that the we wanted to share with you a few other points, and that is with respect to the person we are going to be engaging. Parliament itself is short of legal staff. I understand some people may have left, others moved on into other parts of Parliament, and I did have distributed to Manco, I'm not sure if this has been distributed to the committee at large, but it should be with the committee at large at some point. It is the curriculum vitae of someone, Kathy Idenson from the University of Cape Town. This will be available to you. The Manco did look at this and scrutinize it. We were particularly interested in qualifications and practice in respect of company law, international law in this regard, and so on. But I think it would be far better for you to have a copy of this so you can scrutinize the 3 or 4 pages at your leisure. I'm not yet aware just when we will touch sides with her, because, as you know, the committee secretary has been away for a long time and continues to be away until next week. But Ms. Herling may know now when she was going to try and arrange for Ms. Idenson to come in as soon as possible. Any ideas? Right, Mr. Hermans has been, and as soon as I get that information, I will share that with the committee. We also have with us... yes, indeed, Dr. Milo, you are excused. I just said you're welcome to stay should you wish to. This is a public meeting. Right, thank you. But we also, Mr. J. Pema, who's helping us, if you like, more on the content side of things, but also as a practitioner in this area. And we do have someone who has just stepped in today. Mr. Hermans in the committee section. If you have not been getting your documents, that could be because we have had that difficulty with the secretary not being here at Parliament and on official study leave. But if you're short of any documents, please let Ms. Herling know, or is it yourself, Gershon? Mr. Gershon? Yeah. Ms. Herling will liaise with the person who has stepped in. But you, by now, you need to ensure that you have every document. If you look at the draft, and it will still be a draft until we just adopt it on Tuesday, you need to ensure you have all of the documentation so that you will be able to deliberate in an informed manner about the company's piece of amended legislation. We would still be on target to complete this process by the first week of March, all being well. Let me just put it that way. Are there any questions in respect of where we are going and how we are dealing with things? Any questions from anyone or comments? Yes, Honourable Harris?
It's just a small request. You mentioned documents. I don't think we have the copy of the regulations for this bill. If those could be distributed.
In fact, I had asked Ms. Herling about that because I understood the draft regulations were out, but they have not yet been made available in hard copy to the committee members. I understand that it is there. People have made references to it. So perhaps you can indicate to us where these draft regulations are. I mean, even some of the presenters have been making references to it, but we haven't seen them, so we're not too sure what they are referring to. So it'll be very helpful. Is there any other question or clarification required? No. Just to finally alert you to the importance of Friday sessions when they are held. We've tried to keep this to a minimum, but we would like to remind members of Parliament that Friday is a working day in Parliament itself, not in the constituency per se. Monday has been allocated by Parliament as a party political constituency. Period. But we cognizant of the situation and in political environment in South Africa, where we're all well aware that there are local government elections, clearly we will try to keep Fridays to a minimum. but I am appealing to members this, as we come into this quarter, can we all please try to be here on time? I'm aware that some members were, and that this morning we did have a lot of other exigencies that did crop up. I also want to appeal to the Secretariat. If we can have documents given to us, it is incredibly difficult for us to follow a submission in the absence of any document or PowerPoint. And I think that members need to keep that in mind of the public who are making such presentations to us. Yes, Honourable Smiley.
Chairperson, you referred earlier to our draft document, our program that has been tweaked and retweaked. Maybe just for the sake of members, a soft final version to be resent to us with possible dates as far as we can do that. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, we're hoping to give this to you tomorrow morning, but just to indicate, there is one on Tuesday the 25th at 9 a.m. and again on Tuesday the 25th is the response, the consideration of the draft annual report, etc. And is it not one public hearing? All right. On Wednesday, we were going to continue with deliberations on the company's amendment bill, but we thought that may be too soon. You know, we need to assimilate and absorb what the minister has said. So we're just having a Manco meeting then, and on Friday we will begin the deliberations on the company's amendment bill. Please diarise Friday at 9 o'clock and refrain from booking flights back to wherever before 2 o'clock. Thank you. Sorry, Honourable
Hadebi. Honourable Chairperson, I think that even in the report, in the program, I think that in principle we must strengthen the oversight issues. Now, I think that if we can have a quarter, at least have two oversights, and then, or if not two oversights, we must also have the follow-up from what we did in the past. Take, for example, we went to the Eastern Cape, we tabled the reports to the Parliament, which were adopted to the Parliament. We don't know now how far were those issues raised in those reports implemented. I think that within the program, that thing must be integrated so that our oversight cannot just become a touring visit. Instead, they must have an impact on the people who are visiting. Thank you, Chair.
We do want to tackle that under the review of the Strat Plan, but it is going to be prioritised without a doubt. I know that the chairs are having meetings right now in this, which will include that issue, so is the Whippery, and I know so are other political parties separately, as it were. So when we come on Tuesday, I was reminded by the Whip that he's sure that there would be some time available once we've got this draft program to really